Good afternoon and welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson, director of the Friends of the Eel River. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. So my guest this week is Eric Loomis. He's a labor and environmental historian at the University of Rhode Island. Welcome to the Eco News, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe we could start by talking a little bit about what labor and environmental history are and how you came to be interested in doing both of those.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think that from a fundamental definitional point of view, you know, labor history is the history not only of labor unions, which is how many people think of it, but of working class people and of work. Whether we're talking about slavery or we're talking about traditional labor unions or we're talking about domestic labor today, people who were forgotten. So a really broad environmental history, which is a newer field, is basically the study of how humans have affected nature over time, but also how nature has affected human development. So that can range from anything from land management issues to public health to the urban environment, really an incredibly wide variety of things. And I came into these issues. My own personal research, I'm looking at how logging unions in the Pacific Northwest served as basically environmental agents of their members, that they would push for the various environmental ideas or programs or needs of their members. And that can be, again, a wide variety of things, whether we're talking about the industrial workers of the world, the radical Wobblies in the 1910s, fighting in the Northwest over issues of public health. You had these incredibly sick loggers, but it was basically a public health, environmental justice kind of issue before we had those terminologies. Two issues of forestry, but I only mention it in passing because my background very much shapes the ways that I think about these things and how I got involved in this, because I grew up in Springfield, Oregon in the 1980s, and my father was a core layer in a plywood mill in Eugene. So this was during the Spotted Owl crisis, you know, and at the same time, I was part of a timber household. I was also this young kind of environmentalist. And, you know, my dad, he was, you know, working incredibly hard. He'd come home and he worked with this glue, and his clothes would be covered with this purple glue that they would use to glue these sheets of plywood together. And, you know, his arms today are this massive scars from splinters over the years. And there's some joint issues, you know, bad hips or whatever, from working in the mills all these years. But, you know, at the same time, when he could get a little time and he wasn't too exhausted, he would take us up to the forest and we would go hiking or fishing or camping or whatever. So when this is all going down, the Spotted Owl crisis is going down in the 80s, and you have this very heated rhetoric from both sides. Some of the rhetoric from the environmental community was talking about the workers didn't care about the forest, et cetera. Not everybody believed that, but that was out there. Certainly the loggers believed that that's what was being said about them. And I didn't think that was true. And so I kind of kept that in my mind and went on to college. My dad was always like, you're never going to go into the mill. Like, you're going to college. You're not going to follow me. And so I did. And I became really good at history. And so I wanted to go on to graduate work. And in between that period, I served as a union organizer for a while. So I always kind of had foot in both camps. And so I began to explore these questions of my childhood when I went on to do my PhD. Now I'm writing this book that is going to try to build some bridges, hopefully, between labor and environment.
So what I'm hearing is it's fair to say that you do both labor and environmental history at once, really, in your focus on the nature of work and the nature of these struggles over Pacific Northwest forests.
Yeah, there's a growing group of environmental historians who are really looking at issues of labor and nature together in a number of ways. So it might be one of the things I look at, for instance, is how the unions, especially the International Woodworkers of America, the IWA, which was originally a CIO union, Congress of Industrial Organizations, which was the more industrial-based radical union in the 1930s, how in the 70s, they use OSHA regulations as a way to empower their members at the workplace to protect themselves from a number of hazards, whether we're talking about wood preservatives that some believe cause cancer, something called white finger syndrome, which was basically, it was a debilitating syndrome that debilitating to the edge of your finger from chainsaw vibrations. So trying to do regulations on those sorts of things. So that's one way, for instance, that people are looking at labor and nature together. I think that one thing that I'm doing that's a little bit different than how a lot of historians are doing it is I'm really looking at labor unions and how labor unions as organizations think about and act upon the nature in which they work, in this case, the forest, but also the mill and the processing side of it, too.
If you're just joining us, this is the Eco-News Report. I'm Scott Greeson, director of the Friends of the Eel River, and I'm talking today with Eric Loomis, who's a labor and environmental historian who works out of the University of Rhode Island but comes from Springfield, Oregon. Springfield was, at the time, a mill town par excellence. There probably aren't very many examples, maybe Coos Bay, a few other towns that were completely dominated by timber industry as Springfield was. How much has changed in Springfield?
Well, so, you know, Springfield's a complicated place because Springfield's always a decent-sized city.
Right.
So like a place like Coos Bay, you know, it's not just a one-mill town. It was a multi-mill town. But it's a little different in the sense that it's right next to Eugene. Right. And that leads to some complexities because, of course, Eugene, center of liberalism, center of environmentalism. So in some ways, I think growing up in Springfield, if anything, made me feel that divide and those questions even more because the cultural divide was right there. It wasn't, you know, and like I suppose it was here too in many ways, but it's not like being in a small town like a Coquille, Oregon, for instance, which was a mill town, where you probably had a few environmentalists, but you didn't have a huge environmental community. Well, Eugene is one of the centers of Northwest environmentalism. And so there was a lot of dislike toward Eugene and a lot of hostility expressed toward that larger city. Today's Springfield, you know, it's changed a lot. It's grown a lot, but it's grown in weird ways. The older areas of town are not very nice. Downtown Springfield is a disaster zone. It's awful. And for a while, it was changing because you had a good bit of Mexican migration, and they were buying up some of the storefronts, opening some restaurants and some stores to cater to that community. But, you know, I was there last week, but a lot of those stores have closed, and I don't know if that's from recent deportations or the economy or what, but it's terrible down there. And really, you know, much of old Springfield is not good. And what's happened there is that you do have development, but it's in a new area of town called the Gateway Area, and that's where the mall is, that's where the movie theater is. That's where the new developments are, and that's where people go. But Springfield proper, I mean, it has some advantages. If you're a University of Oregon student, and the housing is cheap and it's served by good Lane County bus lines. But as far as long-term residents go, I mean, it's poor.
Yeah. I asked the question because I see precisely the parallels you just outlined between the Springfield-Eugene kind of pair and the Arcata-Eureka relationship. It's really been kind of a striking parallel over the years.
Driving into Eureka, where I'm staying this week, while I do research here at Humboldt State, I was really struck by how Springfield-esque it was.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely has that very Springfield feel, you know, very working-class culture.
So just talk a little bit more about labor and environmental history as disciplines. It strikes me that both are, in an important way, politically charged to a greater degree than even regular history, whatever that is. And, you know, places where even studying them seem to be sort of taking a side, even if it's only the side of memory against forgetting, where you're standing up to power and the ideas that support power relationships. And maybe you could talk just a little about how that shapes your work and what that's like in academia, in the larger intellectual life of our culture.
When you're doing labor and environmental history, there's many ways to do these things, but especially with labor history, you are almost inherently critiquing capitalism, critiquing the exploitation of workers. And with environmental history, there's a variety of methods, but certainly one of the things that I look at and a lot of people look at with varying degrees of emphasis is capitalism's exploitation of the land. Now, unlike most environmental historians, I have a labor organizing background. So that puts me a little bit different. I talked earlier about the connections between labor and environmental history that are growing, but usually that's coming from people who have environmental backgrounds. And so it's a little bit different, I would say. And there's oftentimes a little bit less focus on unions as agents of change. It's a little bit more abstracted. But I think that at its best, both labor and environmental history provide very, very powerful critiques of capitalism and build connections between the exploitation of the land and the exploitation of people. Because from the perspective of a corporation, whether we're talking about a U.S. Steel in the early 20th century or we're talking about Georgia Pacific in the early 21st century, both land and people are there to produce profit. So from a corporate decision-making perspective, both land and people are problems that need to be solved, and they both need to be controlled in order to increase profit. And of course, cheap labor and lack of environmental restrictions are the primary reasons for globalization, right? This is why companies want to move abroad, because they can pay people the wages that people made in the United States 100 years ago, and they can dump whatever they want to in the rivers and in the air. And so, you know, I think that at its best, labor and environmental history can come together to not only build connections in the past, but to hopefully get people to understand the nature of capitalism in the present. When I say nature capitalism, I mean both how it operates, but quite literally how capitalism shapes the natural world.
But I guess what I was trying to get at in that question, that challenging capitalism, raising questions about capitalism, is something that's likely to get you unpleasant attention from the kinds of folks who support universities, who are the boards of directors. It's inherently a political act and one that creates difficulty.
Well, I think certainly that can be a possibility. I think that I'm somewhat immune from that right now because I'm still an assistant professor, so I don't have to go to a lot of meetings with fundraisers and these sorts of things.
Right.
10 years down the line, that could be very different.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to rely on the ideas of academic freedom. I think that one thing that academics can do that other people can't necessarily is say things that are not generally accepted in society. You know, I wrote a story last week at Alternet about the Gilded Age, late 19th century, and how we're recreating those terrible conditions today. And my wife's brother, he works in the finance industry, and he's a Democrat and a good guy. And he was like, "Do you have to ask permission before you can say those things?" And of course, the answer is no.
Right.
That's one thing. Look, academics may not get paid well. You know, we may be under attack on our wages and our unions and all of this, but we can say things that people in power don't necessarily want to hear. And that's part of the reason for some of the attacks in recent years on academics who are speaking out, on public sector unions who protect those academics and these sorts of things, because the University of Virginia recently,
right,
with the ouster of their president, who had done nothing except protect departments like classics and German from being cut. The business people who sit on boards of trustees and who are the power players, they see academia as a place that threatens them, because this is the one place left in society where they're being critiqued consistently, and where it's really the only period of American life that in many ways that they don't have a lot of control over, given that they control the media, certainly workplace and churches today, and these sorts of things. So, you know, that is one of the advantages of being an academic.
My sense that even here on the North Coast, where there's a long storied history of labor struggles in the timber industry, and of course, a really strong history of environmental struggles as well, that there's really very little general knowledge of that history. And I'm hoping that you can at least start to pique people's interest in these stories and what they mean for us, not only in who we have been, but what we are today and where we're going.
Here on the North Coast, you do have a vigorous, active tradition of labor struggle and labor radicalism. I mean, to go back to the 1930s, you have the attempt by woodworkers and others to organize in the 1930s that leads to a massacre here in Eureka,
yeah,
which I believe led to 3 deaths of workers. What are these people organizing around? Yeah, sure, it's about wages, but when we think unions are about wages, we miss the point, because unions are only partially about wages, and what they're really about is about respect and about giving working class people a voice at the table. And so wages was part of it, but it was also, these people have no kind of health care. They had no pension plans. They worked long hours. They didn't really have weekends necessarily. And certainly, even in the 1930s, you're looking at 5.5, 6-day weeks. And so basic kinds of things that we take for granted today, you know, people say, well, unions are irrelevant, but they don't understand that unions provided all of the amenities about everyday life that we totally take for granted, like a weekend, like an 8-hour day, and these sorts of things. And so here on the North Coast, that's what these people are fighting over in the 1930s, and as well as not only loggers, but longshoremen, which had, of course, San Francisco had a radical strike in 1934 that was led by a man named Harry Bridges, an Australian immigrant who was not scared of associating himself with communists. And that was in the 1930s, the communists, especially here in California, they played leading roles in securing everyday people basic rights rights that we take for granted today.
There's actually been a one-man show on the life of Harry Bridges touring here recently. So
oh, that's fantastic.
Really interesting to see that history
yeah.
you know, brought to life, literally. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's a book by a man named Frank Onstein, who lives right around here, was a member of the International Woodworkers of America union activist, about the 1935 massacre in Eureka. You can get the book on Kindle. I know it's just been re-released on Kindle.
Maybe you could repeat his name and spell.
Frank Onstein, O-N-S-T-I-N-E. And it's a great book going over what happened here in 1935, a totally lost history. I very highly recommend it. And so you always had a sense in this area from working class people that they needed to fight for their rights, and their rights were things that I would call, in many cases, environmental. You know, how much wood dust are they breathing in? How much pollution are they breathing in? What's in their water? These are issues that they're fighting for. You know, do they have decent health care? These kind of things are very important. And then, of course, the North Coast also has a vibrant history of environmental activism. And of course, as the story goes, these labor activists and these environmental activists, they don't necessarily like each other. That's a lot more complicated than people make it out to be. I mean, it was not a simplistic story. There was a lot of conversations between working class people in the environmental community. There were differences, though. I mean, the environmental community, where it begins in much of the United States, it's much more of a middle class and upper middle class phenomenon, because in the 1950s, when you really see the roots of the modern environmental movement, who are the people who are pushing for this? They're people who have time and extra resources to go on the weekends or to take vacations and go enjoy the redwoods. Go enjoy Yosemite. Go enjoy the Grand Canyon. Now, in the 1950s, that's a rapidly growing number of people, at least among the white community of people of color, you know, that not so much, but with the rise of suburbanization and these sorts of things, you do have a growing middle class, again, mostly white middle class, that are engaging in this activity. And so that's part of the reason why you have this active environmental movement really begin, is you begin to have this mass of people who get involved. But they're not necessarily the loggers themselves. That said, the loggers are also going out, and they're fishing, and they're hunting, and they're hiking, and they're doing these things too, but they also relied on timber harvesting for their jobs. And so as these things begin to get more complicated during the 60s and 70s, where you begin to have pushes for preservation, you have debates within the working class community about this. And certainly, probably the majority of workers on the North Coast were opposed to Redwood National Park, particularly opposed to the expansion of Redwood National Park in 1978, opposed to spotted owl protection. But it didn't have to be that way. And there are certainly examples of workers, and particularly of unions, that are very open to working with environmentalists. And so the history is really quite complex, and that doesn't even get into organizations like Earth First and others that add a whole nother level of complexity to these issues, and we could certainly talk about that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that came to my mind as you were talking about what unions are fundamentally about, you know, it's more than just wages, is a book that really has shaped my thinking about these issues, E.P. Thompson's Making of the English Working Class, where he writes about the emergence of a working class of people as distinct from feudal society. But the people he writes about, who we call Luddites today, I've often argued on the basis of Thompson's work, weren't people whose primary interest was fighting technology or smashing the machine of capitalists, but people who were concerned with retaining control over the conditions of their labor, with holding on to the days that were theirs, and circumstances in which their lives were their own to control, and the lives of their children too, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I hear echoes of that in your description of sort of the modern industrial union.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the key questions of unionism and of labor generally, even if we don't think about it in these terms today, it's still a key question, is control over our lives, control over our workplace, control over our hours. And yeah, I mean, the Luddites they're stereotyped as these machine breakers, but that's not really what they were about. I mean, there may have been some broken machines, but as you point out, it was about control over the workplace, control over their own lives, and a resistance to an industrial capitalism that effectively wanted to treat workers like machines. And it still does. Workers in the United States eventually resisted being treated like machines. And then, you know, in the 1950s, when it was clear that they were not going to necessarily retake control of the workplace, at the very least, if you're going to be treated like a machine, you're going to be compensated well for it.
Right.
industry resists this from the very beginning. And again, this goes back into these questions of globalization we talked about earlier. But, you know, when we're thinking about control over hours and our lives and these sorts of things, today we're in a situation where unions are on the decline, where industry and government have combined to crush unions on both first the private sector by moving jobs abroad and now the public sector through these attacks like we're seeing in Wisconsin, in Ohio, and in other states. And then through powerful media campaigns have convinced many working class Americans that unions are not in their interest. But at the same time, what do we see today other than, you know, of course, we see unemployment, underemployment, debt loads, all kinds of things that are very much working class issues, and we're trying to figure out what to do. But another thing you're seeing is for those who are working, you're working longer hours. Tradition of the 8-hour day, 40-hour work week that unions put in that gave us the old union slogan, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, 8 hours for what we will. And that was very powerful and moved Americans who were working these incredibly long, difficult hours. They could just, you know, if they could even get a half an hour less a day, if they could move from 12-hour days to 11.5-hour days,
yeah,
they'd get 2.5 or 3 hours a week of their lives back. Right. And we've let that slip.
You were writing about the miners in Idaho's Coeur d'Alene district who went on strike after the owners demanded that they work.
It was more hours for less pay.
7 days a week, yeah. 10 hours a day instead of 9 hours a day,
right,
for less pay.
Right, yeah. Right. So, you know, and until people realize that these question of hours and of control over your own life are central to what unions do and central to what you need to be aware of in your own life, how many hours are you working compared to what you were working many years ago, people are opening themselves up to exploitation, and that's what we're seeing. I mean, I was reading something, a really powerful report, New York Times, in conjunction with some blogs about the rise of black lung disease in West Virginia again, and one of the issues is that the average miner in coal miner in Appalachia is working something like 10 hours a week more than they did 30 years ago, exposing themselves to this coal dust, making them sick and killing them. And so until we get our work hours back to 8 hours a day, I think that we're opening ourselves up to a massive exploitation and the slow repeal of a century or more of positive gains that unions provided for working class people in this country.
Well, and I guess the point that some people are starting to raise about this larger set of issues is that we live in a society we think of as a democracy, but the conditions of most people's lives through most of what they do are powerfully anti-democratic. You know, we live in situations where people do what they are told or they don't have work.
We operate under the idea that if you can vote, it's democratic. And voting is part of a democracy. But it's not all of it, by any means. And you see this in any number of ways, whether it is people trying to stop other people from voting. They're doing in Florida by basically stripping Latinos from the voting rolls in order to throw the state for Romney this fall. And we're Pennsylvania, we're doing the same thing, where a state legislator actually openly admitted that that's what they're doing. Let the cat out of the bag a little bit on that one. But not only that, because workers operate with limited ways to change the world and to change their own lives. As an individual worker, what power do you really have? Do you really think you can negotiate a wage with your employer? Well, if you're extra skilled or you're really well educated, maybe you can. But most people can't. And that's what unions are about, right? They were about combining the power of workers, each one who has only a tiny voice, into a solid voice, into one voice that could demand power from companies, demand power from politicians, and in the mid-20th century, took a lot of power in the United States, but also in Europe and other parts of the world. And we think we live in this democracy, but without a union, what kind of democracy do we really have? Without everyday people organizing for their collective interests, how do you compete against tens of millions of dollars that are being pumped into a political system by billionaires like Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate, and the Koch brothers, who are basically openly trying to buy the 2012 elections? The only organization that working class people and just everyday people, middle class people too, really have to fight that that is a labor union. Maybe somewhere out in the world, maybe somebody could think of something that would be an alternative to labor unions where people could come together. But so far in the history of the human race, in the last 200 years, the industrial era, only labor unions have given working class people a real voice at the workplace, but as well as at the ballot box.
So I first got to know your work, Eric, through the blog that you contribute to, Lawyers, Guns, and Money. What's your role there, and how do you see your presence on the internet as connected to your role, your interest as an academic, as an intellectual? And how does this fit into the shifts in the media landscape we're all living with?
Lawyers, Guns, and Money was a blog that started, I guess, in 2004, really when blogs were beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started by three graduate students in political science at the University of Washington, basically serving as a left of center, but not leftist political blog. You know, it was a blog by people oriented to the Democratic Party, but not necessarily Democratic activists per se, not party people, but
right.
People who wanted to talk about progressive issues. And I was not part of it at that time. I was writing on another blog, a smaller blog that I had started. You know, it was the time of the great blossoming of the blogosphere, where for a very brief period of time, from about 2003 till maybe the end of 2005 at the latest, there was a period where random people could start writing online and people would read them. And it was this growing media.
Right.
Now, that ossified very, very quickly.
Right.
Today, it's much harder for an independent voice to start a blog and get readership. There are other ways that can happen. Twitter, for instance, which
right.
I think is a very powerful medium, but not in that traditional way. And so it grew over the years. And about a little more than a year ago, they invited me on it. And I've known some of those people for a long time. But I have a very different background in the sense that I am an unapologetic leftist. So while they were always a very progressive blog, they didn't have anyone who was an open sort of movement liberal or movement left person. And so that's kind of what I bring to it.
Certainly not a union voice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the two things that I talk about on that blog, that the two substantive things I bring to the table is labor and environment, and some other related issues too, like urbanization and these sorts of things I talk about somewhat. And as an academic, it's interesting in the sense that academic freedom goes a long ways, but over the last 30 years, and this is somewhat related to the decline of unionism, talking about economic justice in a straightforward, open, and sometimes even in your face sort of way, even in the academy, people don't eschew you for it, but it's unpopular,
right.
You know, and that reflects in many ways changes in larger society, right? Where you have over the last 30 or 40 years, this incredibly vibrant gay rights movement that is move toward equality faster than any movement in American history. It's amazing to watch this happen, even compared to when I was in high school 20 years ago, where you have civil rights and women's rights are more complicated in the sense that that has not moved forward as quickly, but you have a black president and you have Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. And so there are more on levels of social equality. There's a great deal of emphasis, and the academy, in many ways, the blogosphere reflects that,
mm-hmm.
that those are issues that people want to read about, want to hear. Labor history as a discipline has been in the doldrums for the last 20 or 30 years. There's no real jobs in labor history. You can be like I am and be hired as an environmental historian and then teach and talk about labor history. But actual jobs in labor history barely exist. People don't study it as much anymore.
This reflects a society turning away from those issues.
Yep.
As you said, you know, there are business pages and what's left of the newspapers, but who writes about labor issues?
That's right.
There are no labor pages.
Right. I mean, labor journalists is a rare breed.
Right.
But I do think people are interested in this. And one thing you've seen, you see this with the rise of Occupy, for instance, you know, we're in, what, year five of economic problems with really no willingness from elites to deal with the fundamental issues of inequality. You know, Occupy is part of a reaction against that. And you begin to see people beginning on the ground, and you see this on the internet, to talk about these issues in new ways and to begin to rethink, okay, you know, what do we need? How do we achieve economic equality? And so those are some of the areas that I've been able to tap into and try to contribute to in my limited way.
Well, and I got to say, I find a kind of sustenance in the internet where I can find voices like yours writing about the things I care about, where I can't find that in the newspapers anymore. One could never really find it on the mainstream media, if we mean television and commercial news. But there's a risk of that richness, that multiplicity on the internet also reflecting a kind of dangerous fractionation where, yeah, you're out there, but the right wing's not reading what you're writing.
Right.
They're lost in their own kind of insulated world.
Yeah, and there's no question about that. You can reach communities and that's powerful, but the question is, can you reach communities in a way that's going to increase people's power? If you look at the history of newspapers, newspapers have always existed to serve a particular constituency. And we have this idea, I think, about the media that I think is somewhat inaccurate, in that there was this great time of the media where there was these multiple voices and you had your Edward R. Murrows of the world speaking with their wonderful voices about these issues, and Murrow goes after McCarthy or whatever. And there's this kind of idea that both sides really need to be legitimately presented, etc. But the reality is that the media throughout most of U.S. history has basically been partisan as all get out. And if anything, the modern media with its fractioning out into all these different groups is more like 19th century media than the 1950s were. So any decent-sized city in the late 19th century, early 20th century, is going to have dozens of newspapers, and they're not being read by everybody.
Right.
You have your conservative big newspapers, but then you have your ethnic newspapers, you have your labor newspapers, you have all kinds of people are just producing these things, and they serve particular kinds of communities. I think that one big difference is that in serving those communities on a local level, these ethnic newspapers that were in German or whatever, and the fact that they're in German makes conservative people in power nervous because they don't know what these crazy foreigners are saying.
Right.
Are they anarchists? You know, right. Well, some of them were.
Right.
Right. So those papers were organizing communities rooted in place that could come together to challenge those in power on the local level. That goes off in the workplace. Today, yeah, I mean, you know, I have people who read what I write and they like it, and that's awesome. It's very exciting for me. But Scott, you're here in Arcata, and someone else is in Massachusetts, and someone else is in Texas. Well, I mean, there are ways that people can come together, the online activism and things like that, but I think it's much more difficult to create change without that kind of local community thing. And I think that's one of the powers of, say, locally based environmental movements, you know, too, that, you know, here on the North Coast, you had various environmental groups that were rooted in place, that were working on issues around a place. And certainly they might have been able to be helped. The internet was, say, a big deal in the 1980s or whatever in bringing attention and these sorts of things. But in the end, a lot of the change was created because people decided, I don't want to see clear cuts in these ancient redwoods. And that in itself provides a great deal of power because people could come together over a particular place. And I think that one of the things about Occupy that was important, and we'll see where it goes from here, but is that people were organizing in real places again, talking to real people about real issues that affected their community. And, you know, we hadn't seen that in a while, and it was refreshing, and hopefully it portends a future where people begin to do that again and meet, create change in the local community, because you can't create national change without creating local change.
This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Scott Greeson, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guest today, again, has been Eric Loomis, a professor of environmental and labor history at the University of Rhode Island. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Thereafter, you can find the files from recent shows posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. You can find Friends of the Eel River, the organization I work for, at eelriver.org. If you have questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. None of this could happen without Fred McLaughlin. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.